Hello and welcome to the first episode of the Racing Riot podcast with myself, Joshua Stacey, and my co-host. He had almost 20 years in the saddle. He rode 195 winners, including the famous Welsh Grand National on the Bobye. It's Mr. Charlie Post.
Hi, Josh. How are you? I actually rode over 200 winners because there was ones on the flat as well that went with that. But I'll let you off. You know, it's the first show, and I know that your facts and figures will improve throughout this ongoing series that's going to actually happen. Seriously excited to be here. Freshly retired, obviously, a guy that has always talked too much, way too many his opinions, and I'm hoping, certainly my wife-to-be is hoping, this is going to be an avenue for me to vent these feelings.
Absolutely. We hope this becomes your fortnightly horse racing fix, full of debate, fun and opinions regarding racing's hottest topics. So let's get cracking. Charlie, it's been a big year for you off the track. You decided to retire. Just for those that may not know, how come you decided to hang up the saddle?
Throughout it, like the last few years, I've been sort of building up to this moment. I mean, probably some people would say that I checked out and should have retired a couple of years ago. Just other things in my life were building up alongside my girlfriend. We've been building a pre-training breaking business. We break in horses for Ollie Murphy, Dan Skelton, Ian Williams, Jonjo O'Neill, Graham McPherson, Ben Case, on and on and on. And we started this about 4 years ago as something that hopefully I could then move into once my career finished. And to be honest, we've been both taken aback by how quickly it's come upon us with the numbers. As in last winter, we probably had 50 odd horses in most of the time in the yard, which is huge, really, and beyond our wildest dreams. And it just got to the stage where when we moved to our premises we're on now 4 years ago, I was still riding out 4 or 5 days a week, a full-time jockey. And then as the years have gone by, my riding out has dwindled to the past year. I was probably only really riding out for Robin. And I'd got to the stage, to be honest, mate, where I only had 70 or 80 rides that year. I felt like a bit part player. Now, I'm a massively competitive person. And I kind of got to the stage where I was hating going racing because you're like that spare part, you know, the guy that turns up to a wedding that no one really knows anymore. And it just didn't feel right for me.
Yeah, that's interesting because I watched you on Luck on Sunday and you said that it wasn't the career you hoped for. Now, you've ridden some huge winners, Classic Chase, Welsh Grand National and graded races, and you won round Cheltenham multiple times. What did you mean by it wasn't quite the career that you hoped for?
I just went on there and I thought there's this like sort of cliche wherever anyone retires and they go, oh, it's magical, I've had all these brilliant times. And don't get me wrong, I've had some brilliant times and stories and mates and that we're going to talk about throughout this, you know. But what I meant was, there's a childhood dream, isn't there, for most of us when you get to play sport. You know, I love sport all the way through. I found my way into racing. Like, I came into the job and I wanted to be champion jockey. You know, I grew up, I remember getting Richard Dunwoody's autograph at Toaster when I was a child, you know, and seeing him winning on Mini Homer and stuff like that, being champion jockey, obsessed with it. And, you know, that's what I wanted to do when I came into the sport. And then the realization comes upon you either through opportunity. Only so many people can be champion jockey. Only so many people can ride hundreds of winners every season. Or maybe a lack of talent, whichever, that you're not quite going to attain those heights. And you have to reevaluate everything, don't you? You know, as in, so instead you become, well, okay, I want to ride some big winners. I want to have a career. I want to make money. Because that, again, is something as a child you don't even take on board. You know, you want to be champion jockey. You want your name in lights. You don't think about, I actually want to earn a living. And when that reality hits home, that becomes what it's all about. So, and then you have to reevaluate your goals. So a lot of the time, I mean, I was saying to you, like, it's a very difficult sport from a competitive point of view. As in, even Tony McCoy probably only won one in every four or one in every five rides. Yeah. You know, for those of us lesser, further down the ladder, you know, I'm probably looking at riding a winner, you know, one in every sort of 60, 50, you know, rides or whatever more. And so you have to be able to, for your own mental well-being, change those goals. So all of a sudden you're riding 66 to one shots. So your goal becomes, well, the betting says you should finish last. Let's go out and beat two, you know. And so you try and find new goals throughout it all. And then you hope by working hard, doing your job for all the people that you ride for, that the big winners will come along. And luckily for me, there was a few of them. So they're the ones that I will live with me until I get old, hopefully.
You had those great memories. You also had some low moments. What would you say your highest moment was as a jockey?
I think just for pure euphoria that the win in the Welsh National was. You know, I think I was 28 at the time. Like I've said before, I've been toiling away for a long time, you know, as in it was, you know, I started my first ride on the flat when I was 17. Never really wanted to be a flat jockey, but was sort of 5 foot tall, 7 and a half stone when I left school. So that was the avenue I went down initially. But, you know, 17 to 28 is a long time without a real, you click on the Racing Post website, I can assure you, and the first thing you look for on your own thing is big race winners. And it gets pretty depressing to keep clicking on there and saying no result found. So you want that for your own sake. And so at 28, I'd been riding for 11 years, having good seasons and riding plenty of winners and doing okay. But your desire is for those big moments on TV. And so that feeling after the Welsh National was one of euphoria and joy, but also coupled with relief, because it meant that even if I retire tomorrow, there's something that's going to go down in the history books that I actually did all right with.
I was probably too young to remember that, but going past, and I've gone back and I've rewatched it, and it's a cracking ride.
Just going on to that, I mean, you say you're too young to remember. I mean, a bloke said to me yesterday that you're 9 years old, and yet here you are hosting this podcast on Twitter, didn't he?
No, I think that's just because I've got an extremely young face. I definitely have a baby face, and I've always have, so.
Yeah, I mean, one of the guys said you get ID coming in the building because the security guard think you're bunking off school, no?
I don't think I look that young. I think the height makes up for it, but yeah, definitely wouldn't mind a few facial hairs. I think it'd help me out long run. But what would you say your lowest moment in the job was?
Lowest moment?
Maybe not a specific moment, but what did you find difficult to deal with on either a day-to-day basis or a season-by-season basis?
I think when, you know, things are tough, I mean, probably initially when I was starting out, I had a good first year jumping, had 12 winners. And the second year, I'd only had one winner. Things were going poorly, you know, I kept falling off the odd horse. It was mentally, it was kind of frying my brain. And then I broke my arm as well. And so I spent a lot, like 6 weeks, 2 months out. And, you know, they're things that are hard to deal with. Like, I think any jockey will say, I've been very fortunate throughout my career not to have had a huge catalogue of major injuries, niggly things along the way. But it's probably the time out is tough, you know, inactivity. You just desire to be back, especially when you're probably not a big name, because at least if you're a big name, 9 times out of 10, you've got your job to come back to and you've got that stature, you know. As a middle of the road jockey, you know full well, hey, as soon as you get injured, the likes of the big agent in jump racing, Dave Roberts, he might be my agent as well, but he's messaging every one of the lads on his book saying, Charlie Post, he'll be out injured for this amount of time. Get in, ride out for Richard Lee, Robin Dickin, Matt Shepherd. So you know that it's a competitive world. You're out injured. You can't keep your name up there with anyone. And you know that everyone else is desperately trying to take what you've got. And whether they're scraps or not, they all want them. And you're worrying that when you get back, are they still going to be there for you, the rides? And are you going to have to rebuild from nothing?
Have you noticed a massive change from when you first started riding to finishing your career last year?
I think I sort of like started around the real like advent of the job becoming way more professional, you know, as in you'd hear stories from time gone by, the lads living it up, having the crack. And, you know, over my career, all of a sudden you know, the breathalyzing has come in, drug testing, all of that. You know, jockeys, there's been so much more come into them as a professional athlete. You know, even with the support network, we have access to sports psychologists, physios, nutritionists, all of these things to try and make the job better. But therefore, you do get a change in atmosphere within the rain room. You know, that it's become infinitely more professional, clean, sort of, you know, everyone revolving around riding winners. But then maybe that's just because I'm getting old, you know. Probably the guys from the generation before, when they got to the end of it and I was the young lad coming through, were like, oh, it's not like it used to be in my day, you know, because that's life, isn't it?
Yeah, talking about young jockeys, you've obviously, you've been fortunate to be in the weighing room with some incredible jockeys, some big names, some small names. Who would you say right now, so you finished last year, who would you say right now is the young rider or a group of riders to watch out for? Who do you think in 5 years time, 10 years time, they'll be at the top of the championship?
I think right now, as in, like, Harry Cobden's a guy that I've got phenomenal respect for. If I'm being personally honest, when he got the job with Paul, I thought it was going to be tough, you know, as in I thought he had a lot of furnishing to do and everything like that. And Paul is a brilliant trainer, he's a tough guy to ride for, you know, as in since Ruby, there's been a lot of changing about who's going to be stable jockey. And I thought the way he settled into the role was phenomenal. You know, I think there was the top of the game issue in the Feltham at Kempton when, or what it's called now, the Corto Star, the Novice Chase at the Boxing Day at Kempton, where I think he got it slightly wrong. And you're thinking, is he going to shrink away from it? But he came roaring back and with the absolute icing on the cake with that moment being winning on that same horse at Cheltenham, where he delivered a ride of serious class, you know. And the more I've watched him through the season, the more I've come to think of him as a very, very talented young rider that's grown into the role. He's got a lot of self-belief as well, which I think is important with a job like that. And the other one from that team was Sean Bowen as well. I mean, I was surprised initially that Sean wasn't considered for the job, you know, at Paul's. And I'm surprised he's not an even bigger part of the team there. I think he's an excellent young rider too, you know.
Yeah, I remember that ride at Cheltenham. I did put top of the game up. And it was the first time I'd taken my girlfriend's family to Cheltenham. It was a big deal. It was a big day. I wanted to impress them. And we didn't have the winner in the first, but that was the first winner we all had together. And they were telling me after how much of a special moment it was. We were sort of tracking him all the way down the hill. Santini and Delta Work had gone off. And it was such a patient ride. And yeah, it was a great moment. So thank you, Harry Cobden, for that one too.
Exactly. And then, I mean, again, going back to Paul's team, like you've got to look to Bryony Frost as well, you know, as in, like she's grown into that role massively. I mean, I know she got huge media coverage because she's a female jump jockey doing very well. But when you actually look at it and get away from gender and whatever else, like she's made up into an excellent rider again. And, you know, Froden and horses like that she's developed that rapport with. I mean, she doesn't do an awful lot wrong either.
Yeah, Frodon's definitely had an incredible year. I was lucky enough, Harry Durham messaged me whilst at Cheltenham once, and I managed to meet Frodon one-to-one, and he's such a special horse, and he's provided the whole racing world with so many memories, and Bryony is definitely a big part of that. Who would you say is the best jockey that you've ridden with or worked with? As in the most talented.
It's a real difficult one. As in, I was sort of thinking about this on the way down, and I, you know, of natural talents, I sort of got a list here. You know, as in, Timmy Murphy was a brilliant, brilliant rider. You know, had his bumps along the road within his career, but within the weighing room was actually a really nice, quiet man. You know, and rode in exactly the same manner. Rode so short, such incredible timing and patience. Probably all the things that, you know, that someone like myself would aspire to be, but it wasn't really my style, you know, but you'd always watch him and admire him. And in that sort of mold, the Ruby Walshes and Davy Russells as well, you know, as in like the Davy again is someone that I see plenty now at the sales and stuff. And he's a real character as well. You know, he's always telling me that I need to buy some land, have a schooling feel for all the British trainers to come and use. He thinks that's the way, like in Ireland, that, to make loads of money, and he's always on to me about stuff like that. And then the other one that probably not as big a name, but a guy that I'd spent a lot of time with, Paul Maloney, I thought was an unbelievable, underrated rider, even though he rode a lot of big winners, as in just, he always seemed to know where the winning line was. He never, ever went too soon. And he always seemed to deliver them on the line, as in, and it's an incredible skill. And yeah, Paul was one that I always had an awful lot of respect for.
You're Charlie Post. Your training now, let's just put this in hindsight. Yep. Your training, and you've got the favourite for the Supreme Novice Hurdle at the Cheltenham Festival. Which jockey, you're allowed one jockey, one ride, who would you have? Who would you say you'd put the most trust in to deliver on the big stage?
Good question. I think, you know, Cheltenham, Davy Russell, I think he's pretty phenomenal around Cheltenham. He ice cool, nothing ever seems to bother Davy Russell. I think I'd go for him. I mean, just moving back to that about the best riders around, like, and then going back to the all-action stars, like, you can't go very far wrong from Dickie Johnson and Tony McCoy, you know, as in brilliant riders in a different way. You know, AP would ride off a lot shorter contact than your Davy Russells and Ruby Walshes and all that, and a lot shorter stirrups-wise, but in a different way, every bit as brilliant, you know. And just going on to it, as again, a great friend of mine who looks now like if Dickie retires, that he's going to be the heir apparent to being champion jockey, Harry Skelton. There's so many good riders in the weighing room that, given chances, would do even better, you know. And like, you look at Harry Skelton, before his brother started training, I think he rode 8 winners that season. looking like he's filtering out of the game. Like, what's changed, Josh, for Harry Skelton?
It's just opportunity. Obviously, the money that's gone into Dan's yard and the horses and the caliber of horses they're able to attract, obviously, with his past being with Paul Nicholls. Obviously, from an outsider's point of view, I think it's more just the amount of rides, the caliber of horses, and he's just had more opportunities to find winners. He's just on a higher quality of horse. Would you agree?
Completely, but as well, confidence has grown. You know, you're riding over 100 winners a season. You can't help but not be confident. You know, and again, what you're seeing with that operation, which again is something that seems to be dying out at times, is like the continuity of having a stable jockey that's riding out for the yard all the time, doing all the schooling at home. Like, if you're asking me the question, who would you want on your side going down the last when the chips are down, it's neck and neck, Harry Skelton would be right up there because of the confidence he has in those horses of his brothers. He rides at the last like it's not there, you know, as in like there's not a moment of doubt in his mind. Is the horse going to pick up? Is this, you know, are we going to make it? He's riding at it like he has complete belief in what he's riding. And again, I think there is an element that's not drifting out of the job, but we're seeing owners with more and more power, more access to information, making their own minds up about who they want to ride the horses rather than letting the trainer kind of get on the side. Like what from the outside, what do you think makes a good jockey?
It's a difficult one. I'm probably like 90% of those that are massively into horse racing. I've actually never ridden a horse.
Yeah.
I've probably been down Blackpool Pleasure Beats a few times on the donkeys. And
how'd you get on there?
I think I was the only runner, so I'll take a walk over
nicely.
But it's very difficult to explain. When I first got into racing, my favourite horse was Sprinter Sacra.
Yep.
And interestingly, when I first got into racing, I almost thought that as a jockey, almost, I know it sounds naive, but almost any of the jockeys could do any job on each horse.
Yeah.
So I saw Sprinter Sacra, and my favourite jockey was Barry Geraghty.
Yeah.
Because he was the rider of my favourite horse. But now looking on it and studying racing and being so involved in it, I think it's just, for me, timing is key. One of my favourite riders of all time is Noel Feely.
Yep.
He's got very soft hands and he always seems to time his rides very, very well. He's got a good judge of
brilliant rider.
And I think from an outsider's point of view, I would say he would be one of the riders that would be right up there in my list purely because he always looks so composed. He always looks very calm and he always seems to make the right decisions in the races. Even if he doesn't go on to win the race, he's always thereabouts.
But there again is an example of a guy that for a long time, hey, was riding lots of winners. Been, you know, you go back to the earlier parts of his career, like Celibate with Charlie Mann and stuff like that. But the big days didn't really come often until right towards the end of his career. And you kind of wonder why. Because Noel Feely was always a brilliant rider and a great man as well.
Why do you think that was? Why do you think he never got the opportunity earlier?
I honestly don't know. As in, because Noel Feely was an exceptional rider for a hell of a long time. And hey, he was riding for good trainers and riding plenty of winners, so having a great career, one to be proud of anyway. But for some reason, whether he just wasn't in with the right people earlier in his career that had all these big winners, maybe there wasn't an opening for him. But, you know, there was a kind of time when, I think it was like when Ruby got injured and he got started riding Masterminded and he got asked to ride Corto and things like that.
And went on to Silvagnaco Conti.
Exactly. And then the relationship with Potensis, you know, those guys. And then it seemed to snowball from there. And all of a sudden, from being a very, very good rider, probably 50 winner a year, man, comfortably, everyone would respect him. He suddenly became like the go-to rider if there was a spare going in a big race. And before you know it, he's Rock on Ruby, Bouvoudère, you know, all these great horses, but they all came late in his career.
I want the Racing Right listeners to know more about our relationship.
Yeah.
How we met. So if they don't know, my mum married into a family full of racing fanatics, and I was only a young kid. I wasn't really a racing fan. I think my earliest racing memory was a very sad memory, but it was synchronized in the Grand National, because obviously my mum had a connection with that horse because it's Gold Cup win. And I always used to remember the Grand National being on. My mum would turn the TV on and that'd be like my earliest memories. Yeah. And because usually the biggest horses at that time were in gold and green. They were the JP McManus horses. McCoy used to ride them. That was sort of my only a bit of knowledge in racing. But my mum married into a family who had shares in Thomas Crapper.
Yeah.
Obviously a horse you know very, very well that you've had a lot of success on. And yeah, so thanks to my stepdad, because I wouldn't be here now, but that's sort of the way that we know each other. And I remember going to the yard up at Robins when I was 10 or 11 or so, seeing you looking like, just admiring you so much. It's quite fitting. I feel very privileged to be here now.
No, it's good. I mean, it makes me feel old thinking that you're that sort of age when you're coming up to the yard initially, but...
it was only 3 years ago.
Some people don't even think you're that age. But no, as in, like, yeah, I remember you coming up and like, yeah, Thomas Crapper was it. Huge part of my racing career and life, you know, and also I absolutely love, and it's great to see him finish his career and be going on to do something else, you know. As in, again, I think within the job, that these horses are the specialty. It's all you want for them, you know, to finish in one piece and live out the rest of their days enjoying themselves a bit like any athlete, you know. As in, and Thomas Crapper, he was because he was sort of quirky, had a funny name and all that. People always seem to latch on to him, you know. And,
it definitely. I remember being at Ascot when he went for the Holloway's Hurdle, the one that Irish Saint won.
Yeah.
And I remember the whole track just absolutely ploughing into Thomas Crapp. I think he went from 8-1 to about 4-1 favourite within 5 minutes. And he always used to get a lot of heavy support on track, especially because of obviously his name.
And like that day again, kind of showed him, especially in the early days, for what a sort of quirky character could blow hot and cold. They went no gallop that day, I think, and he was way too keen, you know. And that was certainly in an early part of his career. Like he could blow very hot and cold, you know. When he was on, he could look very, very good. And when he was sort of not really happening and race didn't flat plan out for him, like he got beat a lot because of that, you know.
Yeah, he's a horse that we both obviously have a very close connection with. My favourite memory of Thomas Crapper was probably the second Cheltenham win. So he won at the October meeting. He then went to the Open meeting in November and he beat Whisper, who went on to be a Grade 1 hurdler at Aintree that year. He beat some top horses. Obviously, we had the privilege to watch you and Thomas in action. As the rider, what was your favourite moment?
As the rider, what was my favourite moment? I think possibly when he won the Greatwood Gold Cup, you know, because at that stage, like, things looked like they were on the way down for him. Like, he'd been in the doldrums, I think, for quite a long time. And it was an unbelievable performance on the day. I mean, it looked like he jumped in, turned into the straight, as in, for a horse that sometimes found winning difficult and didn't always make things easy, I think that was the easiest ride I've ever had on him. I mean, he hosed up anyway, of course, but as in throughout the race, it was just very, very straightforward. Going back to the November meeting story that you're on about, like, for me, because then he went on to finish second in the conditionals race to Dom Polly, I think, another future Grade 1 winner. But it was galling because Whisper went and won the Coral Cup and he missed out on getting into the Coral Cup. And he'd have actually been in the Coral Cup on way better terms with Whisper than when he beat him early in the season. And that, again, was something at the time I was just pathetic, really, but I was disappointed about, you know, because you kind of left thinking, oh, I wonder what might have been, because he ran a blinder in the boys' race.
That could have been the Cheltenham Festival.
You never know, do you? You know?
Yeah, it's very true. Cheltenham's definitely a special place. The first time I visited there, I wasn't a massive racing fan. I think it was in 2013. And a funny story, actually, it was obviously my stepdad's the big influence with me with racing. And we went there and it was talking all day about the new one. That was before the new one went on to have all the success. And I think it was 11-10 favourite for the Neptune trial on trials day. And I remember I was a naive racing fan and I just thought, AP McCoy is teaming up with JP McManus on At Fisher's Cross. And I remember supporting At Fisher's Cross. And if I remember the race rightly, I think Sam Twiston Davis went a good gallop on the new one. And McCoy, just a classic McCoy ride, stalking in behind and then flew up the hill. And I remember then that's when the competitive edge sort of got me. I remember the atmosphere, like the lights and the horses itself was just incredible, and it's such a special place. But I do want to talk about a debate, because obviously this podcast is going to be full of different debates. And one of the topics that is very current at the moment, though, I do want to get your opinion on, is on Monday, the Thoroughbred Breeders Association released a statement. Robert Whaley-Cohen released a statement, and he said, the TBA is delighted with the announcement of the addition of the Mare's Chase at the Cheltenham Festival. The BHA have made great progress with strengthening the Mare's Race programme in recent years with input and the full support of the Thoroughbred Breeders Association. The introduction of the Mare's Chase at the festival has been one of our key objectives. We believe this will encourage more owners and trainers to buy and race mares, which will improve the breed by ensuring that they are tested as breeding prospects on the basis of racing ability. So basically, as that into short, there's going to be a Grade 2 mares race over 2.5 miles at the Cheltenham Festival. What is your initial reaction? Because I know there's been plenty of debate over on Twitter and various social medias, and everyone's sort of sticking their thumb in. What was your initial reaction?
I think it's a good thing. I've thought about it long and hard. There's been times where, like, say, for example, the Mayor's Novices Hurdle, I wondered whether they had a place and whether they took away from it. So I looked into this about the chase option, because it's going to be an open chase, isn't it? Not a novice chase.
Yeah, it's not a novice chase.
So going towards this, what was the last time a mare has finished in the first three in the Gold Cup?
I don't think I could.
Juba Silla was second to Master Oates in 1995.
Wow.
So there was a part of me that went, well, are we taking away quality and strength? And then I thought, well, obviously not, as in stats tell you, not really, you know. And then going to the Ryanair, how many horses, mares, have been placed in the Ryanair since its inception in 2005?
You're going to have to tell me.
Two. Javol was third to Alberta's run in 2010, and Mafiel was second to Uxisandra in 2015. So I thought about it long and hard, and then what it's trying to do, it helps breeders, you know, as in it makes the job more viable for people that want to breed horses, which is the future of our stock, and we need this coming through. It also gives these mares an outlet, and there's some incredibly good mares that we could see running in this race. And of course, they still got the option of the absolute pinnacle, the Gold Cup, or even the Ryanair, but I just don't see a downside into having something like this race and giving the mares a chance to get their name up in lights. It will also encourage, hopefully, people to keep mares and fillies in training and watch them go through to run over fences. Now, maybe there's an argument that that's why it hasn't happened so much, because they've been retired before they've really gone chasing, if they've got black type. This is another option at the biggest stage of all to see mares and fillies get a go.
I agree it's a good initiative, but there are so many, I think Cheltenham especially right now, there's so many 2.5 mile chase options. So if you're a novice, you've obviously got the JLT, and you've also got the novice handicap chase. And in open company, you've got the Brown Advisory and the Ryanair. I looked at this on last year's festival. So a Plutard isn't a mare.
Yeah.
But he was a steering job in the novice handicap.
Yeah.
And he was a genuine Grade 1 horse in a handicap that should have run in the graded races. And the reason I bring this up is because I look at Willie Mullins, and it's rumoured that Lorena will be going over a fence this season. Since this announcement of the new race, a lot of people have been linking her to this race at the Cheltenham Festival next year. I know that she'd be a novice, but Lorena is world class. She finished fourth in a champion hurdle, albeit slightly disappointing, but she still ran a good race. And I think she can prove it against the boys. And like, for instance, Quivega, she won the Mayor's Hurdle 6 times between 2009 and 2014. And she was, there's no getting away from the point, she was a phenomenal mare. She'd turn up every year and she'd win. But we never got to see her in a champion hurdle. We never got to see her in a world hurdle. Big Bucks was so dominant at that time. And I thought that was a real disappointment. We never got that matchup that, as racing fans, as racing supporters, we've always wanted. Do you not think that this race could just be like the benefit mare's hurdle for Quvega? And do you not think there could just be one horse that's dominant, that should be running against the boys, that ends up running in this, like Yularinas, like Benny Dujour? The mare's hurdle was at her mercy last year.
Yep.
And she is a fantastic mare. And I almost find it disappointing that we don't get to see her against the champion hurdlers, the world hurdle horses.
What we have at the moment, due to his dominance, is we have a Willie Mullins monopoly on a lot of quality animals. So if, say, I don't know, a good trainer, but not an absolute, not a Willie Mullins sort of kind of guy, had Benny Dujour, would they be more likely then to picture into a Ryanair or something like that, because they haven't got so many others for these races? Do you know what I mean? Is there not an argument that it's more, some of these big guys have got such a lot of talent, it's a natural sort of reaction to split the talent up? So Benny Dujour might go for the mare's chase because they've got all these others for the other races, possibly.
I agree, but it was such an exciting moment when Annie Power went for the champion hurdle, because obviously she had that horrific fall at the last in the mare's hurdle the year before. And it was so, such a great moment seeing her take on the boys, seeing her win against the boys. And I feel like this race has the potential to take away those star mares that may not be around at the moment, but could be around in the future. I just think it'd be disappointing. And I think I was more infuriated seeing Lorena being linked with this race next year when she's never jumped a fence. She's good enough. I think
if she jumps,
she would be, in my opinion, I think she'd be good enough to run in a JLT. She'd be good enough to run in an Arkle.
But then is your argument not the issue is that Cheltenham has become such the be-all and end-all? Because I can assure you now, from a jockey's point of view, a trainer's point of view, it's about trying to have winners there. So if you got, let's take Benny Dujour, for example, and she's going to be even money favourite for a mare's chase at Cheltenham, or she's still going to be a short price, but one of the contenders for, say, a Ryanair. For your owner and trainer and jockey, you want to go for the mare's chase because you want the winner first and foremost. It's about winning. And I can see from the outside looking in that the racing fan, which I am one, would love to see everyone take each other on. But I think this is a really good thing for the breeders and for the strength of the sport and bloodlines moving forward, that there are more opportunities. It also is that it gives people the option to get involved at value, because it is infinitely easier to try and buy a sensibly priced younger filly than it is a gelding, say, you know. And then at the end of it, you do have the option of them becoming broodmares and whatever else. So I think this is a good thing for the breeding industry. Whether it's the greatest thing in the world for those of us that, like you say, are looking for the best to take on the best, possibly not.
The Cheltenham Festival is, in my opinion, the best taking on the best. I think there's so many ways that trainers and owners can duck and dive from meeting these big horses now with the introduction of this race. We're going to get the opinion over in the social scene. On the line, we have Adam. His name is at WoodyHRT on Twitter. He's built up a nice following over there. I am a fan of his through his fantastic write-ups that are full of details. And he has a real passion for the sport, which is exactly what I like. Let's head over to Adam.
Good afternoon, Josh. Good afternoon, Charlie. Really, you lads are both keeping well. Before I start things off, I'd just like to say a massive thank you to the both of you for allowing me to feature on the opening show of the podcast. You know, it really does mean the world to me to be handed this sort of opportunity at such an early stage in the podcast itself. And it goes without saying, I wish you both the best of luck going forward with it.
Thank you very, very, very much, mate. That's very kind. On reflection, where do you stand with the introduction of the new mare's chase?
I generally feel like the introduction of this new race is something that will be a great addition. And more so for the future, I feel like the renewals at the start may not be as strong as they could be for the future. But I'm sure it'll be well attended by owners and trainers as the years go on. And I'm sure that the renewals will grow stronger as the years go on. And I really feel like people will start to appreciate it in the next couple of years, you know, for the kind of race that it potentially could turn out to be.
Interesting. When a race like this is introduced, more often than not, a race has to make way. If that decision was in your hands, Adam, which race would you replace it with?
In terms of the race to be replaced, as tough of a decision as it is to make, I'd have to say it's going to be the Fred Winter on the Wednesday. You know, the Fred Winter is normally a race full of well-handicapped horses that are still somewhat unexposed in the hurdling sphere. And over the past few years, you know, we've seen just over 20 runners supplemented each time. I do, however, feel that it's becoming much more of a regular occurrence that the race is being targeted by, you know, genuine Triumph hurdle contenders, and there's a possibility that if the Fred Winter was the race to go, that this could make for a much more exciting Triumph, you know, when you see 22, 23 runners in the Fred Winter, as opposed to, you know, only 8, 9 or 10 in the Triumph, you know, whereas once upon a time, you know, the race used to have roughly the same amount of runners. Like I say, I do feel if the Fred Winter was the one to go, that it would make for a much more exciting Triumph, you know, make it the grade one that it truly is. To finish things off, I'd like to have a question to Charlie, if that's okay. I'd love to hear your opinions, Charlie, on the 4 miler on the opening day being reduced by a couple of furlongs. And more in particular, you know, on this year's renewal, with some of the amateur jockeys in the race receiving suspensions prior to the race. You know, this year's renewal, it's fair to say that it wasn't the best viewing, you know, on the public eye, with only 4 of the 18 finishing. You know, the conditions weren't very good that day, but I would like to hear your opinions on the BHA handing out suspensions to the jockeys prior to that race. Thanks a lot, lads.
Cheers, Adam. I mean, what I want to start with, Adam's all over the mare's chase, so he knows a lot more than you do, Josh, and we should have him on more often, as in people that agree with me are all good. The National Chase, I think the new sort of restrictions that they brought in, dropping it back in trip slightly, I think there are now requirements for the riders to have had at least so many winners over fences and so many rides. These are all good things. You know, the job keeps moving forward. We, you know, in such a competitive nature, in the National Hunt Chase, let's be under no illusions, it's a high-class race. There's plenty of very, very good staying chases have come through it in its history. So competitive nature like Cheltenham, I think it's a good thing that we're going to bring tighter restrictions to the riders. Some of these top-class guys, Jamie Codd won it last year. Jamie Codd is better than most professionals, you know. If Jamie Codd was a smaller guy, he'd be an absolute top-class professional jockey. Brilliant rider. So these Irish guys and plenty of the English lads are fantastic, but tighter restrictions are a good thing. The ban to Declan Lavery was a farce, you know, as in when we're starting to ban lads that finish in the money at a Cheltenham festival, the job's gone crazy. I know AP at the time was up in arms about it on TV and he was spot on, and I think it got overturned at appeal, you know, which has since prevailed, thank goodness. My view on the race that should go, I think it's very difficult. I would probably say if you're going on a quality point of view, the Fred Winter's the one that should maybe step aside. But unlike Adam, I don't want to see a throwback to a day where we have 20-something runners in the Triumph Hurdle. The one good thing about the Fred Winter is it's brought a much more select quality feel to the Triumph Hurdle instead of the absolute carnage that used to happen in years gone by where you'd have horses not good enough running and they'd just be filling the field up and getting in the way of the good ones.
So it seems the one thing that I do agree with everyone on on the first episode of Racing Riot is that the juvenile handicap hurdle, in my opinion, would probably be the one that I would want to make way. That's my views. Let us know what your views are over on our Twitter. Make sure you go over and follow at Racing Riot on Twitter to keep up date with the podcast. And if you're interested in getting involved in future podcasts, just like Adam did, make sure you go over there and send us anything. Show what you want us to do, and we will try and fit you in. Thank you very much for listening. We hope you did enjoy it. It's obviously the first one, and we're hoping this can become a nice series for us both.
Oh, we really hope that. And I think, you know, as the time go by, it'll be more about current racing news than sort of an intro, as in I think this is just the start of it.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely the start of big things to come. Make sure you go over and download the Racing Post app. You can subscribe to the Racing Post Members Club to access all of our in-depth data, tips and unlimited replays of all British and Irish races, plus access to tomorrow's digital paper from 9 p.m. So head to racingpost.com for the full details. Anyway, other than that, subscribe to the Racing Post on audio platforms so you can tune in next. It'll be in a fortnight's time, won't it?
That's what I'm led to believe.
Yeah. So it'll be in the next one will be in 2 weeks' time. We hope you did enjoy this podcast, and we're looking forward to keeping you around and keeping you a regular listener. But anyway, thank you very much. It's bye from me.
It's Bye from me.
And hopefully we will join you in a couple of weeks for the next Racing Post Riot.